Text 37. Thomas Hardy. Alec and Tess.
She was silent, and the horse ambled along for a considerable distance, till a faint, luminous fog, which had hung in the hollows all the evening, became general and enveloped them. It seemed to hold the moonlight in suspension, rendering it more pervasive than in clear air. Whether on this account, or from absent-mindedness, or from sleepiness, she did not perceive that they had long ago passed the point at which the lane to Trantridge branched from the highway, and that her conductor had not taken the Trantridge track. She was inexpressibly weary. Only once, however, was she overcome by actual drowsiness. In that moment of oblivion, her head sank gently against him. D'Urberville stopped the horse, withdrew his feet from the stirrups, turned sideways on the saddle, and enclosed her waist with his arm to support her. This immediately put her on the defensive, and with one of those sudden impulses of reprisal to which she was liable, she gave him a little push from her. In his ticklish position, he nearly lost his balance, and only just avoided rolling over into the road, the horse, though a powerful one, being fortunately the quietest he rode. "That is devilish unkind," he said. "I mean no harm, only to keep you from falling." She pondered suspiciously, till, thinking that this might after all be true, she relented, and said quite humbly, "I beg your pardon, sir."
"I won't pardon you unless you show some confidence in me." "Good God," he burst out, "what am I, to be repulsed so by a mere chit like you? For near 3 mortal months have you trifled with my feelings, eluded me and snubbed me, and I won't stand it."
"I'll leave you tomorrow, sir."
"No, you will not leave me tomorrow. Will you, I ask once more, show your belief in me by letting me clasp you with my arm? Come, between us two and nobody else now. We know each other well, and you know that I love you and think you the prettiest girl in the world, which you are. Mayn't I treat you as a lover?"
She drew a quick, pettish breath of objection, writhing uneasily on her seat, looked far ahead and murmured, "I don't know. I wish... How can I say yes or no when..." He settled the matter by clasping his arm round her as he desired, and Tess expressed no further negative. Thus they sidled slowly onward, till it struck her they had been advancing for an unconscionable time, far longer than was usually occupied by the short journey from Chaseborough, even at this walking pace, and that they were no longer on hard road, but in a mere trackway.
"Why, where be we?"
she exclaimed.
"Passing by a wood."
"A wood? What wood? Surely we are quite out of the road."
"A bit of the chase, the oldest wood in England. It is a lovely night, and why should we not prolong our ride a little?"
"How could you be so treacherous?" said Tess, between archness and real dismay, and getting rid of his arm by pulling open his fingers one by one, though at the risk of slipping off herself.
"Just when I've been putting such trust in you, and obliging you to please you because I thought I had wronged you by that push. Please, set me down, and let me walk home."
"You cannot walk home, darling, even if the air were clear. We are miles away from Trantridge. If I must tell you, and in this growing fog, you might wander for hours among these trees."
"Never mind that," she coaxed. "Put me down, I beg you. I don't mind where it is, only let me get down, sir, please."
"Very well, then, I will. On one condition. Having brought you here to this out-of-the-way place, I feel myself responsible for your safe conduct home, whatever you may yourself feel about it.
As to your getting to Trantridge without assistance, it is quite impossible, for to tell the truth, dear, owing to this fog which so disguises everything, I don't quite know where we are myself. Now, if you will promise to wait beside the horse while I walk through the bushes till I come to some road or house and ascertain exactly our whereabouts, I'll deposit you here willingly. When I come back, I'll give you full directions, and if you insist upon walking, you may, or you may ride, at your pleasure. She accepted these terms and slid off on the near side, though not till he had stolen a cursory kiss. He sprang down on the other side.
"I suppose I must hold the horse," said she.
"Oh, no, it's not necessary," replied Alec, patting the panting creature. "He's had enough of it for tonight."
He turned the horse's head into the bushes, hitched him onto a bough, and made a sort of couch or nest for her in the deep mass of dead leaves.
"Now you sit there," he said. "The leaves have not got damp as yet. Just give an eye to the horse, it will be quite sufficient."
He took a few steps away from her, but returning said,
"By the by, Tess, your father has a new cob today. Somebody gave it to him."
"Somebody? You!"
D'Urberville nodded.
Oh, very good of you, that is," she exclaimed, with a painful sense of the awkwardness of having to thank him just then.
"And the children have some toys."
"I didn't know you ever sent them anything," she murmured, much moved. "I almost wish you had not. Yes, I almost wish it."
"Why, dear?"
"It hampers me so."
"Tessie, don't you love me ever so little now?"
"I'm grateful," she reluctantly admitted. "But I fear I do not."
The sudden vision of his passion for herself as a factor in this result so distressed her that, beginning with one slow tear and then following with another, she wept outright.
"Don't cry, dear, dear one. Now sit down here and wait till I come."
She passively sat down amid the leaves he'd heaped and shivered slightly.
"Are you cold?" he asked.
"Not very. A little."
He touched her with his fingers, which sank into her as into down.
"You have only that puffy muslin dress on. How's that?"
"It's my best summer one. 'Twas very warm when I started, and I didn't know I was going to ride, and that it would be night."
"Nights grow chilly in September. Let me see."
He pulled off a light overcoat that he had worn, and put it round her tenderly.
"That's it. Now you'll feel warmer," he continued. "Now, my pretty, rest there. I shall soon be back again."
A clamber over the hill into the adjoining vale brought him to the fence of a highway, whose contours he recognised, which settled the question of their whereabouts. D'Urberville thereupon turned back, but by this time the moon had quite gone down, and partly on account of the fog, the chase was wrapped in thick darkness, although morning was not far off. He was obliged to advance with outstretched hands to avoid contact with the boughs, and discovered that to hit the exact spot from which he had started was at first entirely beyond him. Roaming up and down, round and round, he at length heard a slight movement of the horse close at hand, and the sleeve of his overcoat unexpectedly caught his foot.
"Tess," said D'Urberville.
There was no answer. The obscurity was now so great that he could see absolutely nothing but a pale nebulousness at his feet, which represented the white muslin figure he had left upon the dead leaves. Everything else was blackness alike. D'Urberville stooped and heard a gentle, regular breathing. He knelt and bent lower, till her breath warmed his face,
and in a moment his cheek was in contact with hers. She was sleeping soundly, and upon her eyelashes there lingered tears. Darkness and silence ruled everywhere around. Above them rose the primeval yews and oaks of the chase, in which were poised gentle roosting birds in their last nap, and about them stole the hopping rabbits and hares. But, might some say, where was Tessa's guardian angel? Where was the providence of her simple faith? Perhaps, like the other god of whom the ironical Tishbite spoke, he was talking, or he was pursuing, or he was in a journey, or he was sleeping and not to be awaked. Why it was that upon this beautiful feminine tissue, sensitive as gossamer and practically blank as snow as yet, there should have been traced such a coarse pattern as it was doomed to receive. Why so often the coarse appropriates the finer thus? The wrong man, the woman, the wrong woman, the man. Many thousand years of analytical philosophy have failed to explain to our sense of order. One may indeed admit the possibility of a retribution lurking in the present catastrophe. Doubtless, some of Tess D'Urberville's mailed ancestors rollicking home from a fray had dealt the same measure even more ruthlessly towards peasant girls of their time. But though to visit the sins of the fathers upon the children may be a morality good enough for divinities, it is scorned by average human nature, and it therefore does not mend the matter. As Tessa's own people down in those retreats are never tired of saying among each other in their fatalistic way, it was to be. There lay the pity of it. An immeasurable social chasm was to divide our heroine's personality thereafter from that previous self of hers who stepped from her mother's door to try her fortune at Trantridge Poultry Farm.